G'day guys and welcome back to the Dylan Friends Podcast. I've got a serious treat for you this week. One of Australia's best and most popular comedians, Nazeem Hussain. You probably know Nazeem from his television shows Legally Brown and Orange is the New Brown. He's performed all over the world, opened for Dave Chappelle, and he's even got his own special on Netflix. In this episode, Nazeem shares what it's like growing up as a Muslim in Australia and how he got discovered as a comedian. We talk about jokes that didn't go to plan, dealing with hecklers and much more. He's a great bloke. I can't wait for you to get to know him better. Let's go.
Welcome to the Dylan Friends Podcast. My name is Deborah, Dylan's mum. Strap yourselves in for some lighthearted and wholesome fun. And don't forget to subscribe and leave a review.
Ladies and gentlemen, how exciting. First of many for the Dylan Friends Podcast, Nazeem Hussain. Nazeem, welcome to the show, mate. It's an absolute honour and a pleasure.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be talking to someone.
Is that how it's been for you at the moment? Obviously, we're in isolation. Have you been doing much? How have you been keeping busy?
You know what? To be honest, life of a comedian, most of the time we are actually at home, except at nights when we're gigging for about an hour or less. So it hasn't changed too much in that regard. I'm pretty used to being at home and finding ways to procrastinate. I'm trying to keep fit at home, you know, doing Zoom workouts with my friend. You know, just do the usual. You start a new hobby, but then drop it a couple of days later. Cooking, but then also eating junk food and Uber Eats. So it's just, I don't know. This is just kind of normal life for me, but heightened.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Like as you said before, mate, I've been doing much similar. I've been watching a lot of Netflix. I've been tuning into your podcast as well, which has been fantastic. Survivor's Guide to Coronavirus.
Yes.
It's fantastic. Now, today, I was listening to an episode. It was your latest episode. I think you dropped it today. And it was talking about the actual workout stuff that you've been doing. Now, it did spur me on, mate, because there was points there that were brought up that I was fascinated about and things really hit me between the eyes. And I thought, shit, this is actually a thing that's happening now. Because people are in isolation. And a bit like yourself, which I'm hoping you'll explain, you're going to be coming out of this a new man. Like, you're sounding like your fitness regime at the moment is going to be absolutely killing it. I actually have gotten a lot worse.
Look, I don't know, Dylan. That's the intention. The intention is you either get fat or you get shredded. So you can't really, you know, I'm a bit of an extremist in that, probably a weird thing to say as a Muslim, but I am an extremist in non-violent ways. I'm either all on or all off. And so, basically, this personal trainer that I've got, Ryan Wilson, shout out. He's a great guy. Trains a lot of bodybuilders and proper sportsy people. And so his advice is basically based on science. He's like, if there's food in the house, you will probably eat it. If you can see it, you're probably going to eat it. There's like, he cited all these studies and stuff, which say if you've got access to it, you're way more likely to emotionally give in. So you've got to just make it, you've kind of got to have tricks for yourself. So you got to have it out of sight. You got to put it in places where you might forget that it's there. So he suggested the car boot or the shed or your neighbor's place or something, but just get it out of sight, which is a problem because, my house is pretty small, so everything's pretty much in reach. and I always buy stuff that's on special. Like, so there's, you know, Tim Tams are like half price. I'll buy like three packets. It's bad. But anyway, yeah, so I've gone a complete extreme where the only stuff that's in my house right now is just the food that I am happy to eat in accordance with his bloody regimen, which is boring stuff, to be honest. But, better to binge eat carrots than chocolate. But
yes, I've always said that, and it's good for the vision as well.
It is. Oh. It's tough because as soon as I finish a meal, I'm just like, oh, man, I've got to wait like 4 hours till I can eat something again.
And that's the thing, isn't it? Like, I suppose what you're saying, that at this time when you're procrastinating so much and you come up with these ideas, like for me, for example, at the moment, I don't know if you know a lot about me, but I used to be an absolute elite AFL superstar.
I
was a genuine superstar. So and I know you know, like everyone knows.
Everyone knows your stats, mate. And you're robbed of the Brownlow every year that you play.
Yeah, well, that's another podcast in itself. But it's funny because since I finished playing footy, I was like, look, I'm never going to work out again. You know, like I've done this my whole life. I'm so over it. But as soon as you get locked into a house, all you want to do is go out. And at the moment I've picked up, and today, even listening to your podcast again, A Survivor's Guide to Coronavirus, all I want to do now is go for a run. I literally went home, went online, and bought like a whole new running kit, because like I'm the sort of guy that if I do something, I need to be in the right kit. Like it's something to do with the uniform. So I went and bought a whole new running kit. I got my runners, and I've pretty much got this plan where by the end of the year, I want to run a marathon.
What the hell? Are you serious? So what? How many k's can you run now?
Today I did the 10, which is about 4 kilometres.
Wow. So okay. So you're 10% of the way there.
Yeah, I've got a bit to go.
Well, to be honest, I'm really bad at like, I can do like maybe middle distance, like maybe 4k. I could probably 4, 5 k, 6 k. Like it's not painful for me. Anything beyond that, I hate it. Actually, I don't really do a whole lot of cardio. I bought a skipping rope, did it for a little bit, but I don't know. I've got to watch more like inspirational boxing movies. They always get me pumped. I'm really surprised that the podcast got you inspired, because literally just before you called me for this, I was just I was just basically eating cereal.
So it didn't work for you.
Didn't work for me. Oh, no, but like, you know, the cereal is like, I intend to normally just eat that for breakfast, but, and then other stuff for the rest of the day. But between meals, I don't know. It's just a pastime. It's just something fun to do in the house.
Well, you got to keep yourself entertained.
Yeah. So how are you getting prepped for the marathon? Are you running every day?
It's only day one. I haven't sorted that out yet, but I spoke to my mate. I listened to the podcast this morning and as I said, I've got the kit, I've got the runners, everything else is sort of good.
Yeah.
Now it's just actually doing the rest of it. I'm thinking I want to run at least every second day. You've got to have at least 24 hours to recover.
Do you normally like start these sorts of health kicks and then give up after like a couple of weeks?
Well, mate, that's the thing. At the moment, it's so hard for me because for so long, like my whole life, it's been my job. And I respect people now that are fit so much more because I was paid to be fit for a long time. Like you'd rock up to a club, and you know what it's like to work 9 to 5. You rock up, you do your work. Through that 9 to 5, that was me just training. So I'd go home.
Yeah.
Now it's like you work and then you have to go and train. It's just like, it's so hard. It's so much harder.
Actually, when you put it that way, like I feel like not being super fat is like that makes me feel really good.
Yeah. No, you've done well.
No, but just generally, I think like that's a really great way to frame not being super unfit. It's just like, well, elite athletes, that's what they're paid to do 9 to 5.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're fit outside of a normal life, you are killing it.
Yeah, no, 100%. And mate, look, to be honest, I've probably gone on for that way too long. That was just meant to be a 1 minute intro, but I'm really happy with how it went, because it was good clarity now, and I'm really happy that you're across my new goals. Look, I want to talk about you because this is what the show's about. As I said, mate, I'm a big fan, and I want to get to the crux of this, because as you mentioned earlier, and the listeners would have heard, I've done your intro and I've absolutely pumped you up to the nines. But being Sri Lankan descent, obviously you migrated from Sri Lanka. Your parents did. Yep. Obviously, you were born in Australia. What was that like growing up as a kid?
Well, you know what? Like, so your producer, Luca, and I, we went to high school together at Melbourne High, which is a pretty nerdy school. people come from everywhere, and you get in based on an exam that you sit, like, you've got to do well on this exam. But before that, I went to the local primary school and then the local high school. And my local primary school was pretty monocultural. Pretty much everyone was white except for me and this other kid, Ramin. He was some Afghan guy. This little kid who just used to always do the sound, you know, the intro music to The Price is Right. That was just him. That was him, and then there was me. And then my older sister and my younger sister, we were the only ethnics in the school. And so you realize pretty quickly that you're the only ethnics in the school. And so, I don't know, looking back, it's kind of funny how as a kid you realize that you are the different person in the class and that you sort of develop coping mechanisms you just have to figure out ways to kind of get by and cope with all sorts of stuff that gets thrown your way. Whereas I don't know if I'm as adaptable now in life. Like if someone says something annoying to me or if I'm slightly inconvenienced, I get real pissed off, and I have to figure out ways to draft passive aggressive text messages or rants on Facebook. Whereas you just sort of like, I don't know, as a kid, you're way more adaptable and you put up with, well, that was me anyway. My personality, I think I developed a bit of a sense of humor as like a weapon.
Yes.
Whereas so my older sister, She probably retreated a bit with that sort of, you know, that kind of like, let's call it what it's like, racist bullying. My younger sister has a bit of the same personality as me. You know, she's quick tongue and can win over some, like a group of people. So I don't know. It was strange. Australia back when we were kids was a very different place to what it is now. Like now, oh my God, so much more culturally diverse. Like we're way more globalized. We sort of all understand each other a lot more. Like to be racist feels archaic publicly. Like you're not allowed to, it's un-PC, whatever you call it. Like it's not right. Whereas back then it was just sort of normal.
Yeah. I suppose.
Yeah, it was a challenging time, but yeah, like now, yeah, it's very different. I don't know how the hell kids like us were able to just get through it so easily.
You're listening to the Dylan Friends podcast. Be yourself. Everyone else is taken.
It's funny that you say that about Australia now, because I feel like, and again, I'm a, you know, just an average white male, and it feels weird even saying that. But
oh, mate, you are above average.
Oh, trust me, I'm really not. And I don't really have any experience with racism at all. But it's really funny because a lot of your comedy, which I'm sure a lot of people have heard, but you like to play up on, not play up, but you obviously joke about being a Muslim and the things that go along with that. And as someone today, like as I was watching, I was actually watching your episode on Netflix today. So Comedians of the World, Nazeem Hussain, which is, mate, it is fucking funny. Like it is hilarious, bro. No, seriously, it is really funny. And the whole time though, I was thinking, like, am I allowed to laugh? Like these jokes, like I'm pissing myself laughing. Like you're laughing about, like, you know, things that I don't even know if I'm allowed to say them. Like,
to be honest, you know what? I feel like what you're describing is the first like 5 minutes of my stand-up shows normally. Like, so normally, you know, if you do an hour stand-up show or 90 minutes, the first 5 minutes when I'm making jokes up on stage, like I can see the crowd, they're not really looking at it. What happens is people that are white in the crowd will look at non-white people and figure out if it's okay for them to laugh. And then brown people will look at white people and be like, oh, he's making jokes about white people. Are they laughing? And then they'll get permission from each other to sort of laugh. Like it's these sideways glances that go on. And then everyone just chills out. And then they like properly enjoy the show, but I always expect that. I'm always just like, all right, everyone is gonna be second guessing each other, because I kind of like, as a comedian, well, I like to make fun of obviously my own experiences, white people, brown people, growing up as a Muslim, so my family. Like you kind of point in all directions. So it's it's interesting how comedy like necessarily has to skirt that line a little bit and cross it and I enjoy like people laughing but also not knowing whether they should laugh. Yeah. I don't know why, but it's really fun. Like until I don't get away with it anymore. But right now it's I'm not in any trouble. So
it, mate, exactly right. I just have no idea what to do sometimes, especially watching that one today. Like if I was in a live audience and the things that you were saying, I honestly don't know, you know, what I meant to do.
Well, that's what I really, really miss. Like the thing about live performance or like live comedy shows is that, yeah, like if you're watching at home, like, or if you're not in the room, thing, like, you don't really enjoy it in the same way. Like, whereas if you're in a room with a stand-up, you're watching a stand-up comedy fest or comedy show, it feels like a big in-joke. Like, the show is for the people in the room, and so you're all sort of in on it, and it's like a shared kind of group experience sort of thing. So, like, yeah, I don't know if that sounds a bit wanky, but yeah, like, doing comedy in the room, like, riding off each other's energy, like, it is just, you know, if there's no energy, if there's no laughter, you can't do it, the show just is dead. So it's a thing that I miss, like performing too. So it's probably weirder watching, like I can't watch myself do stand up to a room, because you're definitely not, I'm not conscious of the camera. Well, you are conscious, but you don't think about the cameras at all, because really you're playing to the people in front of you.
Yeah.
And when you watch it, I feel like, oh, do they get are you getting the same energy? Cause when you're in the room, you're like part of it, you know? So it's kind of like a conversation. Yeah, this is all the theory of comedy.
Oh, I'm loving it, mate, because I've always wanted to chat to a comedian about so many things, which we will get to in a bit. But firstly, I do want to know, how did it get to this? Because as you said earlier, Melbourne High School, which for all people that live in Victoria in Melbourne, you know, to have a comedian coming out of Melbourne High School is probably not something that you would really think is, you know, appropriate. Like, to get into that school, you have to have an inter- you don't you like get in at year nine because you have to give a test to get in or something like that? So
it's really, it was a very, very,
very academic,
nerdy thing. Yeah, it was like we, so I think the rule is a 3% rule. I don't know how it works, but basically, yeah, your producer, actually, Luca Ganano, so he and I used to be really good friends at school, and he was like, well, is, but
he's,
he was
super smart,
a super smart guy, yeah. Super smart guy, very funny, you know, and yeah, like, I think in a way, so everyone, like, I remember the school that I went to before that, Mount Waverley, secondary college.
Beautiful. Was,
yeah, it's not a bad school, but I remember, like, back then, before social media, there were, like, those chain emails, and I remember one of them was, like, you know, it had like, you know, you go to blah school when they X. And so mine was, you know, you went to Mount Waverley when the weed is so good quality, such good quality or something. So like my school was famous for high quality marijuana. And so that was a sort of, and I remember at the school, like I used to do assignments and there was one teacher, she used to literally accuse me of plagiarizing from the internet or from Encarta because she just thought
didn't
that,
believe no, you're that good.
Well, she didn't believe that I could write. It wasn't like exceptional, but like it was definitely like not the standard that she expected from the students. And so I'd have to dumb down my essays. Oh, like my God. It wasn't to try hard at school was not cool. Whereas at Melbourne High, the first thing I noticed was that all the kids would be really excited about learning. And that was like, to me, so exciting. Like I just remember going, oh man, this is cool. You actually can really try hard. And that's, and to be kind of popular at school meant that you did well at school, and that was a really new and exciting experience for me. I thoroughly enjoyed
it. I think I would have been better at Mount Waverley, to be honest.
Well, you know, if you enjoy CBD or whatever it is, they probably still sell it. The students probably still sell it, you know. So,
we'll
not that I'm encouraging it.
No, we're looking. Yeah, we'll
it's kind of science, isn't it? Like,
Well, you got to be passionate about something.
Exactly. So, no, it was definitely not what I expected to do, comedy. I sort of fell into it accidentally. You know,
you're a lawyer, weren't you? But did you?
I studied law and science.
Yeah,
I worked as a tax consultant at PwC for a few years, and I was just sort of doing comedy on the side, just like mucking around. And I did this show called Salaam Cafe with Waleed Ali and some other people in the community, and that was on Channel 31, and then we did a season on SBS, but it was sort of like just stuff that we all did alongside, well, what I did alongside my normal life. And then it just sort of, things got a bit busy and the gigs just kind of kept coming in, and I eventually got a show called Legally Brown up on SBS, which I sort of, you know, that was going to take 6 months to film, so I sort of went to my bosses at work and said, oh, look, I've got a television show. And they're like, oh, you know, is it your own show? I was like, yeah. And they said, well, you know, you could either take 6 months leave of absence or you can just quit and just know that the corporate world is always going to be here. So what do you want to do? And I think they were encouraging me to quit. I just thought I'd take the plunge. And, yeah, then I quit. And I thought I'd be back, but things just kind of kept rolling on. So I never planned a career in comedy. It just sort of happened.
So you were just hustling on the side, like going to those gigs and whatnot. Because I'd go watch when I was living in Melbourne. I'm obviously back in Melbourne now, but I was living in Sydney for a few years. And my missus and I used to go to this place in the city, and it was called like the Improv Centre like that. And man, this joint was the best, funniest place I've ever. I'm gonna get the name of it, and I'll put it in the show notes, but. Basically, it was like amateur comedians and like amateur improv people. So like people that don't know what improv is, it's pretty much like, you know, that like Whose Line Is It Anyway? But like live, and they like say, you know, I'm a cat, and they'll come like tap on the shoulder. One person comes out, comes in, and it was the funniest thing in the world. And I was thinking, is this actually how people get picked up, like to go to like be big comedians?
Yeah, it's kind of, I don't know, like, see, yeah, so there's also, so improv comedians and stand-up comedians, it's like, there's actually a, they're kind of two schools of thought, like, so improv is completely improvised, so it's, so the audience will say some stuff and then they'll improvise some scenes together, whereas stand-up comedy is essentially rehearsed material that's written, and they're both schools of Yeah, they're very, very different sort of forms, but
I think in a polite way, you're trying to say that has nothing to fucking do with what we're talking about right now. I think I've just gone. Shocking story that has nothing to do with.
Oh wow, cool story.
No, it's weird because it's like you've kind of entered into this like this war of worlds. No, like as in stand-ups are like improv comedians, and improv comedians I think look at stand-ups and go, psh, you guys can't think on your feet. So it's sort of like it's this weird divide. But yeah, like that we often share the stage and it's the same sort of thing. But I don't know. It's very weird. Like, you know, the way I sort of ended up on television or doing TV stuff is because I used to do stuff on Channel 31. Yeah, so that's...
SBS, I guess,
yeah,
they did
even before that's Channel 31 and then Salaam Cafe. So Salaam Cafe was a show that we did on Channel 31, which is just a bunch of Muslims talking shit. And then SBS picked that up for a season. And then off the back of that, like, I used to play some characters, you know, and then off the back of that, then this show called Balls of Steel... They asked me to do a character.
I loved that show, Balls of Steel. That was
So that was fun and ridiculous, and you know. And then off the back of that, then SBS essentially offered me my own show, and then that was Legally Brown, and then did that for 20 episodes, and then sort of never really looked back at a life outside of comedy. But it's sort of just, I think now, like, you know, to break in comedy, to sort of become somebody. You know, you can do it a number of ways. Some people just have like a great online following. Other people are hustling at the stand-up clubs and then they get noticed. And, you know, comedians talk amongst themselves and they all sort of know who the... It's way more of a meritocracy than, say, other... Like, say, music. You could be in a band for ages and you could be really, really good. But just for whatever reason, because of labels or the way radio works or the music industry, you might not ever get discovered. Whereas with comedy, it's sort of like if you're funny... It's kind of hard to ignore you for long because, you know, like, yeah, it's not like you need to be a, I don't know. I feel like funny tends to rise to the top more in Australia. Not to say that, but as in like, it's such a small community. Everyone sort of knows each other.
Yes. I know what you mean.
So yeah, we all, and it's really supportive. Like, you know, you compare say music to comedy. You know, like backstage at comedy gigs, you've got like the biggest names, so like Hughesy or Julian Morris or Ursula Carlson, Merrick Watts, like hanging out with like people that have maybe 3 weeks in and just sharing notes or like kind of comparing jokes. Yeah, because you're in a way, you're only kind of as good as your last gig. So if, you know, if a big name goes up, does a joke that, you know, yeah, they're famous, so they'll get some laughs at the top. But then if the jokes have got to be funny. And if they're not getting a laugh, they're not getting a laugh, so...
You're listening to the Dylan Friends podcast. Check out more eps at dylanfriends.com.
Is it true that some of those, like, not naming those people there, but, like, comedians in general, is it true that the big dogs do get some jokes written for them? Is that a thing?
Sometimes, like, yeah, like, I think, you know, for TV, definitely, like, you know... there's always comedy writers that are working on those shows, but you know what? Like all comedians, and I'll including myself. Like if I do a set, as soon as I'm done, backstage some other comedians will be like, oh, you know how you did that bit?
You should try and add this bit on the end.
Blah 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 blah. And we all sort of write notes for each other, and sometimes text them to each other. Like, you know, I think it's kind of just it creates a good culture to sort of share and collaborate like that. And you know, I think. There is also competitiveness, which is good and bad. You know, you sort of want to, you know, the bitterness is weird and is never a good thing, but it's also like it kind of pushes us forward to try and be better than each other, which is why, you know, the best comedians come out of comedy-dense cities like London and New York, where there's heaps of comedy clubs and heaps of comedians trying to get on at these comedy clubs.
Yeah, so you have to be good at it.
Yeah, you got to be good.
And one thing that I'm always... really love looking up on YouTube, you know, when especially in a period like this when there's nothing to do, is comedy, comedians versus hecklers. Now, those videos I love watching. I think Jimmy Carr's got like a million of these sort of videos. In your career had any experience with hecklers? Has anything come up to you like that?
Oh, you know what? Like, so sometimes when people ask me, just like, what's the bit? I actually can't remember specific heckles because they happen so often. It's kind of like, I guess, a tackle in football. It's just like all the time. Yeah. So you'd be doing a gig and then someone will just say something and then you just have to go to them immediately if it's obvious to the room. Like some, the worst is when it's just like just before a punchline and then they say something and they screw the whole bit up and then you're like, oh man, now I've got to deal with this heckler and you've wrecked a joke.
Yeah.
So it's but it's like a, it's kind of like in a way, so you might spend ages writing this routine, you know, like, oh, this is funny, this is great. And then the audience will laugh. But as soon as someone says something drunk in the audience or tries to take you down and then you, you know, say something funny back, for the room, that's the funniest part
that's
of the whole
best.
Routine.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, and you're like, well, I just said something about his mum, and that was the funniest part of the show. Whereas all this cleverly worded stand up shit, they don't care. They just want to see you take down someone in the room. So it's kind of like good. In a way, I'm like, oh, if someone says something, you know, and you can take them down, it sort of proves to the room that you can think on your feet, kind
yeah,
of thing. Like,
yeah.
But also, and also, it looks harder than it is. Like, it looks way harder. Like, it's actually not too difficult. You know, if someone says something. Most of the time you just ask them what they said and they won't repeat it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and if they do repeat it, you've got the microphone, you know, and you can control the conversation. So they're only answering your question. So actually the power dynamic is completely in your favor. You're just making me miss comedy. I can't do this shit now.
It is a highlight. And I, like I said, I watch a lot of comedy and it is obviously one of the highlights of when that shit goes down. I want to know though, like in my career, there's obviously been some really embarrassing moments. It's not like on field, like I'm not a comedian, but yeah. I mean, you know, playing footy and just in life, there's always embarrassing moments. I suppose when you're a comedian, I'm sure there's like, you know, probably not yourself, maybe some other people. There's got to be some times where jokes just don't go the way that you want it to, and
oh,
it just
man.
Doesn't
oh.
float well, or you just sit there and go, fuck, that was shit.
Dude, there's so much. I think one time I said to someone, what are you, blind? And they were. I can't remember. They said something, and I remember saying, what are you, blind? I threw a musical bar at someone, Helen Razor. She was one of the first people that I've had come to the show. She reviewed my show and I remember like I made fun of her the first half of the show, and I used to do a show with another guy, and then I kept making fun of this person, something just kept going after, and then when we were backstage, my friend Amir, he was like, Nazim, that's Helen Razor, she's reviewing the show, you idiot.
Oh, no.
And then I went out there, I was like, hey Helen, sorry about that. I had a muesli bar and I threw it at her and it hit her face because she's legally blind.
Oh, my
so
God.
You know, I just basically threw food at a woman's face. And anyway, she just laughed hysterically, like she enjoyed that. But I've done so many. My career is full of cringe moments, and I guess my trick is just actually forgetting about these things because I'm a forgetful person. But if you think about them, like you'll just want to quit every day.
Oh yeah.
Oh, do you know what I did the other day on Insta Live? This is bad. So I've been doing some Instagram lives. I was talking to someone on Instagram live, and you know, you can invite someone to join
yeah,
your chat.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. So this person was on my chat, and so the comments just keep coming up. You know, that people are just commenting, and someone wrote, "This person has more chins than the Chinese telephone directory." You know, calling them fat.
Yeah,
and also using a racist thing. So I was like trying to delete the comment, right, so that person wouldn't see. Instead, what I did was I pinned the comment.
Oh, no.
And so it was at the top of the chat, like the title of the video, as this person was talking to me. I was like, shit. And so I was trying to not have a panicked look on my face as I was trying to delete the comment. It stayed out there for a good 20 seconds. So I hope she didn't see it, but she probably did. She probably just thought, this guy, I just platformed a troll. Anyway, whatever.
Oh, my God.
So that's in my past as well.
How good, that is such a good topic, embarrassing cringe moments. I actually need to build that into the show a bit more.
Oh, you do. It's so cringe. It gives me like a physical reaction.
No, seriously, it makes everyone feel a little bit better about themselves, I think. One thing about being a comedian, I can imagine, is the old like thing of someone says, hey, I do comedy, tell me a joke.
Oh, tell us a joke.
Is that like the bane of your existence? Is that the worst thing someone can say to you?
It's one of the worst things you could say. I still don't have a comeback for that. I don't know what to say. All I say is, oh, you should buy a ticket.
Yeah.
I have no idea. Like, it's horrible. Like, it's such a... Because comedians don't tell jokes.
No.
They don't tell jokes to one person. Like, you talk to a group of people differently to the way you talk to one person. Like, you don't go up to one person and go, hey, man, the thing about relationships is that, like, it's just this weird thing to start yelling at one person. I just don't know how to explain that. When you don't tell someone a joke, they're like, oh, I thought you were a comedian. And I'm like, well, I thought you knew what comedy is. Anyway.
No, well, let's just like end it now for everyone out there. Guys, if you're listening, just never say that because I can...
Or if you want to annoy the person, just say that.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. It's a great. That's like the number one way to piss off a comedian, and then they'll tell that story to comedians the next time they're backstage at any gig.
Now, we touched on it earlier, but obviously being a Muslim, right, in the... Can I just say something? Yeah. I know this sounds so stupid, but like I still feel weird saying that. Like, does that...
Is being
that,
a Muslim?
Yeah, like I feel bad.
Oh, it's better than saying to me being a Christian.
Yeah. being a Muslim in comedy. When did that... Like, there isn't many Muslims in comedy, not that I know of anyway. You're the probably most famous one that I've
Mate,
come across.
Let's hope it stays that way.
Yeah, exactly. When did it come probably okay? But when did you come to terms with that? I suppose being, obviously it's a strict religion. You make jokes about a lot of things, you know, in the religion, which are funny. But do other Muslims get offended by that sort of stuff?
You know what? Like, first and foremost, I used to do comedy like in the Muslim community, which is probably how originally I started. Like, I was sort of like the community comedian guy. So, you know, I'd be emceeing events or hosting the trivia nights and just sometimes weddings. And so I was like the funny guy. Most people don't have many interactions with Muslims because we're a small community and you just see us on the news. But in the community, we are like super un-PC and we joke around heaps and, which is kind of why we did that show Salam Cafe, Channel 31 and SBS because, you know, we sort of got fed up sort of seeing Muslims on TV not look and sound and joke the same way that we did.
Yeah.
So Muslims come out to my shows heaps. Like they, you know, they're probably the joke suggestions I get after shows, like after any show, people always come up and they go, oh, you should say this or you should say that or joke about this. Muslims tell me the wrongest stuff that I could literally never joke about on stage.
Really?
But yeah, like, so it's kind of like, not that nothing's off limits. Like a lot is off limits. Like, you know, with Islam, with Muslims, you're not supposed to be making fun of people that are probably like, that it's bad to make fun of, so people that are like older than you or that you're supposed to respect and
people blah, blah, with you know, disabilities.
Like, disability. You're supposed to punch up in a way, like you're supposed to speak truth to power.
Yes.
You know, not be someone that's just a bully. You're not supposed to make fun of certain aspects of the religion, or just like, you're not supposed to make fun of God's word and, you know, sacred things like that. But my rule has always been if it's funny, I'll joke about it. And, like, I guess Muslim life is funny.
I feel like you actually, like, and again, I'm not Muslim, so I don't know this, but I feel like you're actually helping break down those barriers, really, when you're doing that. Like, and people could probably take that the wrong way, thinking that they can make the same jokes that you are, which, you know, if you're doing that...
I mean, see what happens.
Yeah, I just don't feel like it would have the same impact. But I honestly feel like it's actually... Well, obviously, it's a good thing, because it's so successful, it's working, but I can't see that...
Like, honestly, I just reckon everybody's got to be able to, like, there should be so many more comedians just sort of speaking their truth. Or, like, because comedians, you know, once you hit your stride, you just end up talking about your life. And the more we sort of hear from different people's lives, like, the more we kind of understand each other. And I know that sounds corny and stuff, but, like, yeah, like, I can't talk about anything but the life that I experienced.
Yeah.
And so a lot of that has to do with me being a Muslim.
You're not making it up.
No, not making up. And I always find the stuff that gets the best response from the audience is stuff that like happens to me personally or that is about me, as opposed to just talking about abstract ideas. You know, if it's something, if it's stories or stuff from my life, that's what audiences laugh at most. So yeah, I reckon, you know, yeah, like breaking down barriers, blah, 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 that's probably all true, but only because people, we don't often interact with each other as much as we probably should or would want to. Like my only interaction with, like, I don't know, like, you know, sometimes the only times you interact with people is maybe when you get in an Uber or, like, with strangers or when you're buying something from a restaurant. Like, otherwise we just hang out with the groups of people that you just want to hang out with. And why wouldn't you do that? So comedy shows are, like, kind of good windows into the lives of different people.
Definitely. Who would you say are some of your favourite comedians that maybe you look up to, I suppose, in the game?
Dave Chappelle, number one. Yeah. I freaking love that guy. He's he's like super funny and silly and smart.
Have you met him?
Oh yeah, dude. I got to open for him when he came to Australia.
Far out.
I got to open in New York. Literally the first time I ever met him, I couldn't speak when I was introduced to him because I'm such a fan. Like, I remember my manager. In fact, my show Legally Brown was largely based on his format. Like, I unashamedly just ripped it off. But because I'm such a fan. But yeah, basically, I remember my manager, she introduced me to him, and she's like, "Oh, hey, Dave, this is Nazeem." And Dave said, "Hi, Naz. I've heard a lot about you." And then I just stood there, like, silent for about 15 seconds. And then she had to go, "Yeah, Dave, he's really excited to meet you. And yeah, look, cool. Have a great gig."
Wow. Was this at the start? Was this at the start of your career, or was this?
Oh, this is in 2013. So right. Like, once
not long
so
ago.
Not long ago. We're just filming the first season.
7 years ago.
So it's bloody long now when you say it like that. But then in 2007, when did Trump get elected? I think it was 2017.
Yeah, not big in 16. American.
I remember something like that. Basically, like, I was in New York the week that he was getting that he had just gotten elected, and Chappelle was doing, like, he was hosting Saturday Night Live. And I just got tickets to do this secret to go to his secret warm up show, which is like a few hundred people. The day before that, I did some gig at a New York comedy club, and I didn't know. I think anyway. So I did that gig. Next day, I went to his special stand up show, and then they basically said, "Oh yeah, this is the warm up act. So just give him a wristband and send him backstage." And I was like, "Oh, this is pretty cool. I get to meet Dave again." But instead, they literally asked me to open for him, and Dave just told me to go up and do 15, 20 minutes. And I was like, what the hell? I had no time to prepare.
Yeah.
And, it was a fun gig. And I thought, like, in my mind, because the audience were reacting so well, I was like, oh, this is pretty rude, you know? Like, you're not supposed to kill it to the extent that you overshadow. But then Dave comes on, and he destroyed it, like, 100 times more than me. So I was like, all right, what an arrogant prick I was, just thinking that I would do better than Dave. Anyway, he was so nice. Like, he remembered my name. He remembered the other comedians. Like, he remembered Ronnie Chang, Matt Okine, because they also opened. And yeah, like, he remembered details about my life and their lives, and like, just a super perceptive guy, despite how many people he meets.
That's sick, man. Who else have you in the game have you met and come across, good and bad, I suppose? Has there anyone that's led a negative impact? That you can say? This show is
really
pretty big.
I'm just trying to think, like, I can't actually, there's some secret, I don't know if you're allowed to swear, they call them secret C's, in the comedy community.
Yeah, I can imagine what
like,
that is.
They're like, you know, so just, there's a couple of people who, you know, the public would be like, oh, he's so nice.
Yeah.
But they're like, behind closed doors, there's all these, there's crazy
You don't have to say the name, but are they Australian? Are there Australian ones?
Oh, yeah. I'm talking about the Australian,
so
yeah.
So there's big ones of that.
There's a couple. I can say a couple. But most of them, I'm not lying, most big name comedians in Australia are like so awesome. Like, there's something about that like probably the older generation, that's not too disrespectful. Is that they're just so supportive, like, and they mentor, and like, it's pretty cool. Like, we've got a really good kind of group of, but I don't know, like, then at the same time, I don't know who all these new up and coming comedians are. Like, I go to comedy clubs and I'm like, who the hell are all these people? Mm. Like, I don't know who the hell they are, but there's a bit of a shit fight, I reckon, amongst open micers to get on stage. But
especially now with social media, I suppose, like, everyone, you know, everyone's got their YouTube channels, everyone's got a podcast, everyone's doing everything. Like, it just doesn't really, like you said, instead of now probably having to actually go on gig, you can just do this and be discovered.
Yeah, totally. Well, there's like, well, I don't know if you necessarily discovered, there's only so many gigs, so many rooms, so many TV shows, so you can either make it online, but to kind of like break into the traditional places like stand-up clubs or like, you know, or television, yeah, it's like, that's where it gets, I feel like it's, I don't know, I don't, it's such a weird, I really don't know, I don't, but you know, like,
mate, there's secret seas everywhere. I think we've just got
secret seas everywhere.
There is, unfortunately, that's the way it is, but without the good, you don't have the bad.
You're listening to the Dylan Friends Podcast. Oh, Dylan, who's your new friend?
TV crew, obviously, mate. A lot of people would know you from I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. fantastic show. How was that for you? How was that experience? You're on it with Dane Swan, who's an ex-footy player.
Yeah.
That's all I know who was on it. Who else was on it?
Casey Donovan, yes. Steve Price. It was like school camp, you know? Like, do you remember, you know, when you think back to school camp, like, we didn't have to organise or think about shit. We just go.
I love those days.
Just like no responsibility, like that, and you get to complain about the food. Oh man, we get to eat this again, and then like the activity, just like, you know, other people are trying to like make you do tasks and try to help you. Really, when you think back, school camp is just like getting you to enjoy 5 days away, and you don't have to do any of the. So that's kind of like what I'm a Celebrity was in a way for me. Like, you just go there, they're looking after everything. You don't have your phone, no bills to pay, and you just eat ostrich anus.
What were some of the challenges that you did on that, like the physical and eating, digesting?
I remember I had to, like, to get into the thing, I jumped out of a plane, which was, I've never done that before. But I also bungee jumped, and bungee jumping is way scarier because...
I'd much rather jump out of a plane than do bungee jumping, I think.
Yeah, because I don't know why, even though... Because there's no perception of the height, because it's just like you can't see the ground.
Too.
Yeah. Whereas with, and also you're pushed out, whereas with bungee jumping, you're standing there and then you have to jump. And your whole body's like, no, the whole point of me is to keep you alive. Like, you know, whereas when you're in the plane, some guy's strapped to you and he's an expert and you've got that confidence of someone that knows what they're doing and all that stuff. I don't know. So I did that. Swam like in underground caves with snakes and little crocodiles.
Oh, wow. So I literally just had like a little anxiety attack. Like, even when you, because I like, whoa, shit, I don't even know if I can say this. I'm like really badly claustrophobic. Like,
oh, really?
Like, really bad. Like, I've never even wanted to tell anyone because, like, I don't like people knowing, you know, like, it's that bad that I don't even like people knowing that I'm claustrophobic. Yeah. And like, you know, with
but what
footy,
sort of space are we talking?
Nah, like confined. Like I even sometimes in lifts, like if there's a few people in there, like I just get a little bit like hot and sweaty, and you know, like if it will like move around a bit, I start freaking out. But it really came from footy because we had the MRI machines all the time, and I'd have so many scans, and like I had my, you know, when you have your shoulders done or back, you have to be fully under it for like 15 minutes, and I was getting to the stage where I was getting like fully medicated to like go in, like put to sleep to go in. So that. That cave thing, and again, this is just weird how so much information can commute in 3 seconds. But as soon as you said that, I had so many dreams about those Thailand kids getting stuck in that cave.
Oh, really?
As soon as you said that, I was just like flipping out. Like, I could, I'd just go, I'd leave. I wouldn't, there'd be no way I could do
that. Yeah. No, that is, because I remember that's full on. Like, and claustrophobia is something like sounds pretty challenging to deal with. I don't know how the hell, I mean. Yeah, I knew someone that used to go through the Burnley Tunnel in Melbourne.
Oh, wow.
And when she'd go through it, like, if she would just, as the car goes through it, she just passed out straight away.
You're kidding.
Like, yes.
Oh, right. So, okay, that's serious.
Yeah.
Okay.
She'd never drive, but yeah.
I'm not that bad, but yeah, that's pretty bad.
Yeah, it's pretty full on, so.
It makes it worse when you're more hungover as well. Like you know, really? Traveling, like, in Europe, we were on those little easy jet planes and stuff, and you'd get on them, you go, geez, this was it's a pretty small plane. And then you're like, oh, fuck, this is actually a really small plane. Then it, like, takes off, like, doors are locked, and you're like, it's pretty small. Like, you know, you start to flip out. Like, yeah.
Well, I think, like, the difference between someone with claustrophobia and without maybe is, like, for some reason we don't think about it as much in that way. Like, as in, I think, like, there have been times where when you think about something, you're like, oh, you're like, oh, I am in this space for this amount, and you can't get out. Like, then it can actually feel quite... suffocating, but otherwise.
How'd you go with it though? You smashed it.
Like the thing, like one of the also, yeah. So when I did all those challenges, there was lots of scary ones. Sometimes you have to climb over like little, you know, like almost like you could fall to your death, except you're not going to. Yeah. So I just used to tell myself, oh, well, they're not going to make me die on national television. This is clearly very safe, and it's all theater of the mind. Like they're just trying to scare you. But, like, you know, having said that, people have died on television before.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, in car races. But, anyway, no, so I just, you just sort of, like, the bungee jumping thing, I can't remember who told me, but, like, as soon as they go, all right, ready, you just got to go, you got to jump on three. You can't, like, if you just, so you just got to just do the things that
just
you're
supposed to. Yeah.
Yeah, you just got to do it straight away and kind of not think, I don't know, I don't know. You think about like people watching at home. I was just thinking about my friends who would just
rip in if you did. Yeah,
yeah, just rip in. I remember like there was this bit where we had to like transfer food with our mouths across a line, and there's this one bit where we had an egg, and I had to pass it to Tom Arnold, who's an American guy who used to be married to Roseanne. Anyway, He's a comedian. And it kind of looked like we were pashing.
Nothing wrong with that.
And so my friends have sent me that like at least 100 times in the last couple of years. Just like, how's your boyfriend, Tom?
Yeah, that's fine. You fit this brief very show. Well, you fit the brief of the show very well. We're all about affection on this show. And kissing on the lips is something that we love doing. So don't be embarrassed about that. Yeah, be yourself.
Look, I mean, I just feel bad. Tom hasn't even called me since the show.
Yeah, that's something to feel bad about.
Exactly.
Post, I'm a celebrity. Talk me through this because well done, kudos to you because you are royalty in this. You are the king. You're the king of Moomba. Now, firstly, congratulations. That's awesome. Secondly, what the fuck? Like, what is that? And like, what the fuck do you do? But
thank you. Look, I don't know what I do now, but like, I've got this crown. So it's I don't know if people from outside of Melbourne, Moomba's like our very Melbourne thing. It's like a some sort of like carnival festival thing. What do you call it? Like. I really should know how to describe Moomba.
Yeah, no, you're not selling it. You've really
it's
done.
It's kind of like the king and or queen of Moomba is like a real. It's an honor. You know, it's sort of like it's the closest thing we have to like the key to the city in a way.
Yes,
like,
okay. So how did you? Because you do a lot of a lot of work. Is that something that goes into the criteria of it?
I don't know how I just got asked and I was obviously super excited. And so there's like, they do this kind of crowning ceremony and at a press conference and my mum came and she basically like stole every scene and was in all of the news articles and stories. But then you do this parade. So there's like, I think they had like 50,000 people lined the streets or the park or whatever. And, then there's like a parade with all these different floats from people from different organizations and dancers and stuff. And then there's like our float, which is Julia Morris is a queen and myself. And we went down this float, and people would wave to us. And as we're walking down the street, people were like quite literally bowing and old women were asking me to knight them. And, it was just ridiculous. Yeah, damn straight I did. As if I wouldn't. I was like hoping that I'd, just be able to, if I walked around Melbourne with that crown on, that I'd get like free meals and stuff like that. But I haven't had the guts to do it. But, to be honest, times are tough. So I might pull it out and just see what I can get.
Do it, man. You've got to do it. mate, to finish up, I do want to talk about a couple of big things. You've got the Netflix doco, which I touched on earlier, Comedians Around the World,
yep.
Which I watched today. Which, again, I urge everyone out there to watch it.
Thanks, man.
It's gross. How did that come about? Because like you're on Netflix, man. That's pretty huge.
Oh yeah. Well, look, it's pretty great. Like I don't know how it came about. I think like Netflix is sort of like they're always scoping for comedians to make specials on there. They want new subscribers from different parts of the world. So. Myself and Joel Creasy, we were the Australians that they got on for that. So that, and then they had, Ursula Carlson and Cal Wilson from New Zealand. And they had like a couple of comedians from, most countries or regions around the world. And, kind of release them as like a global, series. So so you can watch stand up specials from different countries. And that was filmed in Montreal.
That's good. Everything's in Montreal. Is that like the Comedy Central?
Yeah, it's kind of like, the Melbourne Comedy Festival is like one of the biggest in the world.
Yeah.
But Montreal is kind of like the most industry. It's sort of where, the industry, like all the talent scouts and Hollywood producers or big sort of stand up comedians from America, they'll go there and you do like a showcase. So it's less of like, the Melbourne Comedy Festival, you go to watch a show and it's like an hour, whereas over there, it's just like short 5-10 minute spots. And, it's kind of like where people get signed up and big deals happen. And it's kind of like the Olympics, they say, of comedy is the Montreal Comedy Festival, just for last comedy festival. So
royalty, Olympics.
Look, I was just there. Didn't mean I won any medals, but around.
The Olympians, they rock up. Doesn't matter if they don't finish. They finish last. They still get the tattoo.
No, true. But have you heard of how Olympians have to just work like at McDonald's, like straight after they finish the Olympics? It's pretty sad because they don't get paid a whole lot. But anyway, I just remember when I was there, like I'm a comedian that still fanboys over other comedians and you're supposed to be like, oh no, we're all like comedians now, so you don't fanboy over a colleague. But
going to Montreal is so exciting. I just walk around taking, you know, selfies with comedians who don't give me permission to do so. I'm shameless, but it's pretty. I'm having a great time in my career. You know, I get to do fun stuff and pay the bills with it. So, you know, if I have to go back to tax after this, I've had a good run.
Yeah, exactly right. And you know, tax can be fun. Mate, no, you're absolutely killing it. And to you know, travel the world and tell jokes, it's a cool run. And unfortunately, at the moment, with everything that's going
unfortunately, that has now come to an end.
Unfortunately, at the moment, we are not allowed to do that anymore. But that's, you know, once it comes back,
that'll ever happen again.
No, you'll be right. I can feel
it. Once the human race is completely wiped out.
The good news is, mate, people are going to need a laugh after this. I'm sure that comedy will be something that comes. But in the meantime, you have got your podcast, Survivor's Guide to the Coronavirus, which we did talk about earlier.
Check that out.
It's going well. Tell us through it. What's been on?
Yeah, have a listen. That's just me talking shit to other comedians. Survivor's Guide to Coronavirus. Also, I did a series when I went to Sri Lanka last year. That'll be on Audible soon. Just keep your eyes peeled for that. And just, that's pretty much it. I'll be doing stand-up from my bedroom if anybody wants to stand outside on the road and listen. I'll yell out some jokes.
Okay, we'll do that. And we can find that on your website, can't we? Because that's where you've got all your upcoming tours, etc.
100%. Or just on socials, you know. If you're a restaurant and you want to give me free food, I'm happy to accept any and all free food.
Fantastic. We always chuck the links in the show notes, mate. So I'll chuck that in.
Man.
But mate, Nazeem, it's been absolutely fantastic to have you on the show. I hope you enjoyed it, mate, as much as me. I've learned a lot. I feel like a lot of my questions have been a lot of my questions have been answered. As I said earlier, you've motivated me for the marathon. Look, mate, I'm looking forward to catching up once this is all over, and I'll definitely want to come see your show.
Yep, can't wait to touch your face.
Mate, today, how's this for something, by the way? Today, I was essentially going to a supermarket, how do I say this without being an idiot? Some guy sort of came up to me and recognised me from back in the day, and he was a footy guy, and just went so hard for the handshake.
Well, that's all right. Well, just don't touch your face.
I know, but I was just walking around for the next. Sorry. He didn't go for one handshake. He went for two. And the second one at the end, I just did the fist bump. But I didn't have any sanitizer on me for 45 minutes. I was just walking around with my dominant hand in it, trying to pick things out, do you know how hard it is, man? I have my wallet in the right side of my pants. Do you know how hard that is to, get a wallet out of your pants and not touch anything?
That's so funny. That guy needs to have downloaded that app, the government one.
Mate, he had it. I'm not even joking. He had the app because not only did we shake hands, he wanted a photo, and he wanted a photo, but with us, touching. And, I could see his camera, next to his camera, was the COVID app. I'm like, what the fuck? You're obviously fucking into this COVID thing. You're just shaking my hand twice, and
that is how spectacular you are. He is willing to put the community's health at risk to shake your hand.
Oh no, I don't know about that. I just think that maybe he secret C.
Secret C.
Anyway, mate, I appreciate it again. Have a great night. Nice, as I said, looking forward to the shows when they get going again, and thanks for your time.
Thanks, bro.
Thanks for listening to the Dylan Friends podcast. The show is produced by Dylan Buckley and Luca Ganano. Richard Stansbury looks after the audio and editing. Samuel Kenny Creative is responsible for branding and graphic design. And the show is recorded at 3AW Studios, Collins Street, Melbourne. If you would like to contact my son, head to dylanfriends.com or look me up in the white pages and I'll pass it on.